coming from the Harper government, we get this incredible notion that we have to embrace austerity and a rigid austerity agenda. I don't really think the agenda, the top priority is getting people back to work. I think the top priority is doing what Harper and his neoconservative allies have always wanted to do, and that is to, you know, reduce the size and scope of government so that it can't do the kind of things that Canadians want it to do in terms of social policy and redistributing resources more fairly in the country.
So there's no basis for this idea of government largesse somehow getting in the way of innovation and competition?
No, absolutely not. That's just ludicrous. I mean, what we need is government investment because business won't invest. And it's important to notice that business is not investing now. It's not because they don't have the resources. In fact, with all the tax cuts they've had in recent years, they have huge resources. They have huge cash reserves. This has been noted even in the Globe and Mail, you know, a business newspaper. That's not disputed. The problem is they don't want to invest now because there's no demand for their goods, partly because the economy, or really entirely because the economy is depressed and so many people are out of work and incomes are not growing among ordinary people. So when you have that lack of growth of income among ordinary people, then there's little incentive for business to invest. That we saw that same thing happened in the 1920s, actually, and that led to a diversion of resources to the financial sector and eventually to the financial speculation and the crash of 1929, just as it led to the 2008 financial crash.
I notice you're also a big promoter of the so-called Tobin tax.
Let me just back up for a second and point out that the Tobin tax is one idea. There's all kinds of ways to regulate these markets. And for most of the period between the 1930s and and 1980, there were strong regulations in place on Wall Street. They were brought in because people were so furious about that devastation of the 1929 collapse. And they pressured government, and the government of FDR responded by bringing in tighter financial regulations. And those regulations, this is important to note, served well. They limited banks in getting involved in financial speculation. The problem was that they pushed to get rid of these regulations because they don't want to be regulated. They want to have a free hand in doing things. And that led to all those financial deregulation moves in the late 90s. But okay, you mentioned the Tobin tax. The Tobin tax is simply one idea for actually bringing a little bit of order back to the financial markets. And it would do that by imposing a very tiny little tax, something like 0.01% on financial transactions, perhaps currency exchanges or derivatives, so that it would be a very tiny tax, have really no impact on any kind of sort of serious long-term investments that, you know, we want to encourage, but would could add up quite a bit for the kind of frenzied financial speculation that is so much a part of today's financial market. It has, of course, the side benefit that it could raise billions, perhaps tens of billions of dollars a year, which would be very, very nice. And we can think of all kinds of great causes that could be directed towards.
Now, you are a promoter of a progressive income tax system where, if I remember the language from that recent forum that you participated in, it's based more on ability to pay than the beneficiary pays.
Yeah, let's put it this way. It's the idea is that people lower down the income scale, basically need what resources they have available to them, their incomes. They basically have to spend virtually all they have just to meet their basic needs. Whereas as you move up the income scale, more and more becomes surplus, extra, luxury possibilities. And that's fine. But it's the idea is that a bigger proportion of that can be taxed back. The rich can still get rich, but they would face a higher proportion of their income in taxation. And let me just point out, this is not some crazy idea from nowhere. This is, in fact, the basic notion in tax policy, both in, you know, well, throughout the developed world, but, you know, in Canada and the United States, going back to the beginning of the introduction of the income tax in the early part of the 1900s. And in fact, the progressive income tax worked extremely well in the early post-war period, after from the Second World War to about 1980. We had a really progressive income tax in this country. The top marginal rate, like the rate on people with very high incomes on their on the top part of their income, reached as high as 70%. In fact, went as high as 90% some years. That was true in the United States and in Canada. So, you know, progressive income taxation can work very well. I mean, at the same time...
Well, let me just stop you there, because you're referring to a period of time. It was not only the early post-war era, it was also the pre-NAFTA era. And with NAFTA and other WTO and other sorts of structural reforms that have taken place, we've seen a dismantling of certain instruments, like the Auto Pact, for example.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering if in this current era, where we have these trade agreements that have seemed to have enabled these major business interests it's more easy for them to pick up and leave, and there's less controls on what they do. Has that not changed the playing field?
Well, first of all, it's always been easy for business to pick up and leave to some extent. A lot of these policies, these neoliberal policies, there's nothing necessitating these kinds of reforms. There's nothing about globalization or technology that required us to put in place policies that are more favorable to business. The reason that would happen is because business organized very powerfully and was very effective in putting in place those kinds of reforms.
So you're basically saying politicians on the take?
Let's leave out terms like on the take. You can say that if you want, but I'm not necessarily alleging any specific corruption. I'm simply saying that, you know, there were and are extremely powerful interests that, not surprisingly, use their resources to pressure government to put in place policies that favor their interests. I mean, how is that surprising? It's quite striking to look at some of the numbers to show that in that period, in that early post-war period, income was much more widely distributed, both in Canada and the United States, much more widely distributed among ordinary people. It wasn't all just concentrated up at the top. And as a result of that, there were many different things. For one thing, ordinary people had more political clout, because economic clout translates into political clout. Unions were more powerful. There was more laws defending and protecting the interests of unions. And when unions are more powerful, they're able to defend and advance the interests of working people. And they become a counterpower against that corporate power. They're never as powerful as corporations, but they can be something of a counterpower. Now, what happens when you transfer income more to the top, as we've seen in recent years, is that the power of unions diminishes for a number of reasons, partly because more and more money is going to the top. Unions aren't able to deliver their, you know, good results to ordinary workers in the way that they were. So workers are not as satisfied with unions, so they start thinking of getting out of unions. It's a whole dynamic that goes on. But my point is simply to say that when income is more widely distributed and ordinary people are empowered, and unions are empowered, you get a better distribution of power. You don't get the elite, the corporate elite, making so many of the decisions in society. So they, you know, the ordinary people, unions, can push back against the kinds of changes that you're talking about that we've seen since 1980 that are so negative to the interests of ordinary people. Mm-hmm.